Okay. Well, some of you bleed over both places, so. All right. Let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 14. So I want to start moving toward the middle because we're going to start filling it up. Here we go. We're in chapter 14, so take your Bibles and turn there. Remember the, we talked about this last week, that Saul, the pressure, what real life is, begins to reveal who Saul is. And that's what we begin to see here. And remember, he offered a sacrifice to God in disobedience. And then he gets to the place where they're about ready to fight, and he tells his troops, well, don't you eat anything until we've won the victory. Because he wants this big banquet to celebrate the victory. So I guess in his mind he thought, well, you know, if they're really hungry, they'll eat a lot at the banquet. I don't fully get this. But I think it has more to do with what Saul thought would bring honor to him in the victory than anything else. But so he tells them they can't eat anything, and he actually puts a curse on anybody who would choose to eat anything. And remember that his son, Jonathan, dipped his end of his spear into some honey that he found, and he ate it and stuff, and then he got told on. I didn't pass over that. They told on him, you know. So we went to verse 30, and 31, you're going to see some more of the results of a very, very poor leadership on Saul's part. Not only now this affected the royal family, his son, now it's going to affect the people, and actually it's going to lead to the people to sin against God. So let's read what he says here. It says, now they had driven back the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon. Let me just ask you, does that place called Ajalon have anything going on in the back of your mind? Anybody? It's a biblical place. Something very interesting and wonderful happened there. It's a place where God had the sun stand still with Joshua. So, by the way, I've been there. You in Israel, you can go there and stuff. But that's the place where that happened. Okay.
So what happened there again?
That's where. Remember when Israel was involved in battle and they needed more sun and Joshua prayed and God had the sun stand still.
Oh, okay.
That's that valley, that Ajalon, is that place.
Where are we in?
We're in 1 Samuel chapter 14. Okay, so verse 31 is where we're at. It says, so the people were very faint. So they fought that whole day. They pushed back these army. You could just imagine how that would just sap your energy, even if you were eating. But remember, the king says you won't eat anything. So now it says the people are they've grown very faint. And now when you get to a certain place where you're faint and you're starving like these people are, what begins to drive you? Well, your hunger begins to drive you. And you do anything that you can to alleviate that hunger. So what do they do? It says, and the people rushed on the spoil. That's the spoil or the plunder from taking the Philistine. And it says, and they took sheep, oxen, calves, and it says, and they slaughtered them on the ground. Well, why would it say on the ground? Well, part of that, again, is the Jewish people had very strict dietary laws on how they dealt with killing an animal, slaughtering an animal, and preparing an animal. And today, the word that people use there would be kosher. Because kosher is not just a type of food. Kosher is a type of how you prepare the food and what you do and, you know, do you drain the blood properly, and do you, you know, cure the meat, and do you keep it clean, and all these kind of things. Well, what he's saying here is they slaughtered them on the ground. They just killed them, and then they start to skin them out on the ground. And then what do? Well, it says right here. It says, and the people ate them with the blood.
So it'd be raw?
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's a little bit more than raw, so he's not just talking about what steak tartare here. But he's I don't know, Ron, you can tell me. I don't it's not, I don't think it's against their dietary laws to eat something like steak tartare if it's prepared right. You know what I'm saying? So it's not against their dietary laws to eat something rare.
It's supposed to drain the blood.
Well, it's how you drain the blood, how you prepare all that stuff. Here, what you have, the picture is, they're like animals. They kill it, they cut it, they eat it. Go ahead.
On the ground by gallons.
Yes.
So, Jews today, why do they have to have like two ovens and two refrigerators?
It depends, you know, not all of them do. It just depends on their household. If you have what you call a kosher household, quite likely they would just be a kosher kitchen. But you go over to Israel and they have most of the places you go, like the hotels and stuff, they have both the kosher items and the non-kosher items, including dishwashers.
Yeah, because having been in design.
Yeah, and also the dishes that they would serve someone who has a kosher meal, they would not serve that to someone who does not have a kosher meal.
Okay, so what's
the difference? It's just highly ritualistic as if some of it is just, some of it's just over, some of it's over carrying what God said in preparation of food.
Right. What does it mean to them to have just cook separately?
Well, it just means that they're eating proper food before the Lord. Yeah, if you think about it, that was God's original intent, was it not? That they would, the dietary laws were given to them because, remember, they're in the wilderness and stuff. So how do you prepare? How do you take care of this meat that you're going to have? So it doesn't, first of all, so it doesn't easily spoil, and second, so you don't drink the blood that's in it. You know, so he, and what's his thing was, you don't drink the blood because the life is in the blood. And their preparation of meat from the blood was, the blood was part of that sacrificial thing. Okay? And you have, what did we talk about before, Ron? Part of that too was remember when we started this book, that Eli's son, well, they kept back the fat. So they didn't even properly do that. They weren't supposed to be eating that fat. That was part of the sacrifice that was supposed to go to the Lord. So, but initially, a lot of this was really for health reasons. A lot of what you read in the Levitical law, particularly dealing with the Jewish people, has to do with God's concern for them that they stayed healthy when they did camps, when they moved on, and later on when they built community and stuff, that they would stay healthy. Okay? Now, like anything else, many of them have taken that, I mean, just to the crazy degree. And by the way, it's not only Jewish people that do that. We Gentiles do that too. Take things to the crazy degree. You know, we lose the reason for why we did it. Have you heard my little illustration from a Gentile perspective, why we do things? I'll share it with you. I know some of you, if you heard it, just plug yours. I don't care. So, there was this girl. She was cooking, and she was going to cook a roast. And so she gets the roast out, and her mom says, here's how we prepare a roast. She said, you take the roast, you cut the four corners off the roast, you put it in the pot, and you cook it. So the girl says, well, why do we cut the four corners off the roast? And she said, well, I really don't know. I better ask my mom. So the mom goes, Mom, why do we cut the four corners off the roast? And she said, I don't know. I better ask Grandma. So it goes to Grandma. Like, Grandma, why do we cut the four corners off the roast? She said, because, you know, I only had one pan that was about this big, and I had to cut the four corners of the roast so it would fit in the pan. So, you know, the whole reason for that, they just saw that's how Grandma did it, so they thought that's how you prepare. And a lot of things happen that way. And unfortunately, even by the time Jesus arrived, you have the Jewish people that have taken a lot of the Old Testament laws and carried them to a degree that the Lord never intended. Even to including the Sabbath. Remember, Jesus said, you know what? Man was not made for the Sabbath. God gave you the Sabbath for you. It was meant to be a blessing, not to be a burden. And the same thing with the dietary laws. Dietary laws weren't saying, oh, you can't have this. It was that God was concerned about their health and that it would be strong. And so he said, this is the best way to do that. Make sense to everybody? You know, sometimes everybody approaches the laws of God as if God's just sitting there picking out things he doesn't want us to do and has no reason for them. Everything he does has a reason. And the biggest reason is that he loves us and he wants what's best for us. So these people, are so hungry, we see it there in verse 32 of chapter 14, that they literally slaughtered these animals right on the ground and then ate them. Now, did they cook them? They could have. But the point is that they certainly did not drain them properly. They just slaughtered them on the ground, cut the meat out of them, and then went and cooked it. And that's not a proper way to handle the animals. By the way, what's that going to tell you about any animal, any of the carcass that's left after they finish eating? It's pretty much worthless. Where if they handle them properly, once they filled their stomachs, the meat that was left would have still been good for them. Okay? So, again, you know, they reacted in this way because they're starving, because King Saul made this bad decision that nobody got to eat anything until the victory was completely won. Then verse 33. Then they told Saul, saying, "Look, the people are sinning against the Lord by eating with the blood." And he said, "You have dealt treacherously. Roll a large stone to me this day." It's an interesting little phrase. Did you do a little study on that phrase, what that means, Ron?
Which one?
The one on roll a large stone to me this day.
Mine is over here at once. So no, I didn't.
It's some little phrase that I didn't find anything on. So maybe someone's little statement does or something like that. So
it just says if it's to roll a stone over to act as a table. To set up a slaughter of animals to drain the blood properly. So he was telling them.
Trying to do it right.
To do it right.
Okay.
Just like Jesus, when he arose, the stone was rolled away.
Yeah. But his is a better stone. Yeah. All right. So, and then Saul said, "Disperse yourselves among the people and say to them, bring here the man's oxen and man's sheep, slaughter them here and eat, and do not sin against the Lord by eating with the blood." So what Mary says is what it is. Bring a stone. What's it do? It gets it up off the ground, and it can be properly drained and treated that way. Saul's kind of got the thing of trying to fix everything after the barn door's already been closed. And once again, he doesn't seem to take any of the responsibility on himself for the command that he made that would cause his people to be so to that place where you know. You know, when you get to the place where they were, I'm going to eat or I'm going to die. And so I'm going to eat the quickest and the best way I can. So this also will tell you that Saul made no provision during this whole scenario for meeting the needs of his army. So he had not even equipped his armies for this battle in the sense of even providing them sustenance and stuff. But so again, he's trying to fix things afterwards. So, you know, these poor sinful people, they shouldn't have done this. So let me figure out how I'm going to fix this. Now Saul was infamous for doing that, trying to fix things after he'd already made decisions that were bad. So he says he has him do that in the end of verse 34. Says, "So every one of the people brought his ox with him that night and slaughtered it there," which again will tell you that night. That was probably a very long process. Have you ever, just a side note here, when you think about the temple ritual, have you ever thought about how bloody that must have been? You know, all the sacrifices that people brought and how they were slaughtered there and the blood was spilled out and then they were burned. That had to be a very bloody, gory place. And those priests that did that could not have been, you know, standing in white linen for very long, if that's what they had on. So, okay. What's that? Because we're doing Jeremiah. What's a movie on Jeremiah? I thought they did a very good job. But, you know, an hour and a half doing the whole book of Jeremiah is not an easy thing to do. But it talked about Jeremiah's father and the sacrifice that he would do at times because he was a priest. And Jeremiah's place to step into that priesthood because he was a son of a priest. But he never got that opportunity. We talked about that yesterday. Did he ever become a priest? And the answer in the Bible is no. And what they said was, how they portrayed that was, in the day that he was supposed to have his initiation or initial ability to sacrifice an idol was a day that the Spirit of God moved upon him and he spoke out in the midst of the temple And they did not like that at all. So it is a very interesting portrayal of that. So, yeah.
Back to you saying that Saul did things after the fact. Does that not show us that God is very forgiving and patient with us?
In Saul's case, I would say no. Because Saul, what you say is true. God is very forgiving for us. But we have yet to see Saul be repentant of anything that he's done. There's a whole difference between, I messed up, now I'm going to fix it, and, hey, I messed up, God forgive me for messing up, I know I'm guilty of this, I need your forgiveness. And Saul never does that. So that is really the difference. And we see this, he blames everybody but himself. He made this poor decision. He wants to put a curse on his son for a dumb decision he makes. Then he says these people are sinning against God, which they are, in the strictest sense, they are sinning against God. But who put them in that position to do such? Well, the man who won't even admit that he did, that he made a wrong decision. So now, again, he's trying to fix this instead of really humbling himself before God. A good leader would have said, humbling himself before God and actually prayed for these people. God, my decision was horrible, and look what it brought about on your people. Please forgive me and forgive your people. Which sounds more like David than anything we ever hear from Saul. You understand what I'm saying, the difference there? So, all right. So, verse 35. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. This was the first altar that he built to the Lord. And Saul said, let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them until the morning light. And let us not leave a man of them. And they said, do whatever seems good to you. Then the priest said, let us draw near to God here. So Saul asked counsel of God. Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you deliver them into the hand of Israel? But he did not answer him that day. So, here's the thought I always have. Why would we ask God something if we don't intend to hear what he has to say? Huh?
Because I'm impatient.
Well, impatience is one thing, but I think the intent is sometimes even we ask God something that we've already decided what the answer is going to be and just hoping he'll... Okay. Either he doesn't say anything, we assume he didn't say no, okay? Or somehow we'll feel like God agrees with us. But Saul does this. He asks God something, but of course God knows the hearts of all of us. I would say to those of us who are impatient, which I would fit in that category, God, in his answers many times, will be wanting to teach us patience. So he may not give you an answer right away. He might wait to see if you really want to know what's on his heart concerning something. And the most dangerous, one of the most dangerous prayers, God, give me patience. Yeah, now is a good thing. So, all right. So, Saul listens to the priest in the sense of, let's ask God about this. So Saul says, okay. So they ask God about this, and he asks specifically, should we go down? Will you give us victory? Okay. And it says, but God did not answer him. And Saul said, come over here, all you chiefs of the people. I know and see what the sin was today. So what is Saul doing now? Because God didn't answer him immediately. Again, he's going to take things into his own hands.
He said, because there's sin in the camp.
There's got to be something wrong in the camp. But you know the one person that would never look at himself to find out if he's the issue? Is Saul. Saul has some tremendous problems. And they really are spiritual problems. And when you have an unspiritual person trying to make spiritual decisions, you've got a disaster in the making. You hear what I just said? You know, there are a lot of times in churches where people who have not prayed or not spent time with the Lord try to make decisions about what the church should do and where it should go. That's not always a good thing. We want to be in tune with the Holy Spirit before we make some decisions and stuff. So God didn't answer Saul. So look, here's Saul. This is, I mean, he's just, it's classic. So he says, come on over here and see, you know, what the sin was today. I know what it is. Saul, that's what Saul's saying. I would say to you, how does Saul know if God hadn't answered him? He is doing what a lot of Christians do. He's assuming. He's assuming that the way he thinks is the way God thinks. After all, he is God's anointed. And I hear Christians almost say something very similar. I'm a Christian. I know I'm going to make a good decision. Listen, Christian, if you try to make a decision in the flesh, you won't make a good decision. We are dependent upon the Holy Spirit. He doesn't just save us and say, go do the best you can. He saves us so we can begin to hear what he has to say. Because on that side of salvation, we can't hear anything spiritual, understand anything spiritual. We're saved so that part of the reason that we're saved is so that we can have that connection with God, where we can hear the Holy Spirit and where we can, by faith, follow him. And it's sad that a lot of Christians think that their Christianity is, I got saved, now until I die or Jesus comes to get me, I just got to do my best to fulfill what it means to be a Christian. Well, they're gonna blow it. All of us have blown it because we've had that attitude at times. So Saul assumes, like many do today, that his view of things must be God's view of things because he's God's anointed. He's the king. And he's already shown twice that he's willing, at least twice, willing to step into an office that is not his to step into. He built this altar. He had the sacrifice earlier that we talked about. That's not for him to do at all. Everybody got that? So he's crossed that line. So, verse 39 says, for as the Lord lives, now that's a little idiom that's used in the scripture, which is almost like saying, I swear to God, whatever this is going to be is what I'm going to do. That's a strong statement to make. Okay, now I know people just use it flippantly today. When someone always tells me, I swear to God, the first thing I think is, you're lying through your teeth. You know, or I swear on a stack of Bibles. You know, if you have to talk to me that way, you're going to swear on a stack of Bibles. I don't have much trust in what you have to tell me. You know, well, Jesus even taught us that, did he? Let your yes be your yes and your no be your no. Be such people of integrity that you never have to say, I swear to God, I swear on a stack of Bibles, I swear by anything. So, and by the way, his brother James echoed that in the epistle of James. Same thing. Don't go beyond saying yes and no. And mean it when you say it. So when he says, for as the Lord lives, who saves Israel, and I would like this, as the Lord lives, I swear to God type thing. And then let me just add just a little bit more on here so everybody knows that I'm serious about this God thing. It is the God who saves Israel. You know, if you tack Jesus or God's name on something, somehow that gives some sort of validity to it, even if they're no part of it.
You know, Saul used these so-called religious things, like the sayings, and he used them in the past to elevate himself.
Sure.
So that people would revere him and follow him, like when he called for them to bring the Ark of God, you know, when they were in trouble in the battle, as if bringing the Ark of God and setting in the center, it made him, he was making the decision to bring God into this, so we'll be fine.
Right. And might I suggest that what he's doing as he does this, that he's breaking the second commandment. Which says, what's it say? Anybody remember? You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. I don't know how many Christians think that means you can't cuss. Elsewhere in the Bible, it deals with crash talking and stuff. But to take the name of the Lord in vain has nothing to do with swearing and curse words. It has to do with misusing God's name. Appropriating to God that which is not from God. That's taking God's name in vain. Use it in any way that he's not leading you to do it. And that's exactly what he's doing. As the Lord lives, the one who saves Israel. I mean, it sounds good, real pompous and pious. But listen to what he says from there. He said, though it be in Jonathan my son, he shall surely die. But not a man among all the people answered him.
They weren't going to say anything.
Okay.
They probably couldn't believe what he was saying,
or the impact of what he was saying. And they may have think, you know what, he's kind of flipped out a little bit. Besides that, his own words caused this rift in his own family. And we already know that Jonathan is a warrior of God, right? So he would also be a leader of these armies and stuff like that. Can you imagine the conflict in these people's minds?
Yeah, can you see it? What do you do when you've got a leader that's just gone over the edge and everyone's afraid he's got enough power to kill you or have you killed? And everyone just stands there going, okay, what's going to happen now? No one wants to say anything.
But and you've just been taught that you honor the king. You do all these things and stuff like that. It's not easy. These are not easy decisions and stuff. I mean, even our own history has, we have history. Everybody remember the story of Lieutenant Kelly in the Vietnam War and stuff. You know, that he ordered his men to kill these civilians in a Vietnam village and stuff like that. And they had
what in the Vietnam village?
Slaughter.
Oh, civilians. Okay.
Yeah, bring the people out and just shoot them all. You know, and that's a moral dilemma for any soldier because you're taught that you obey, you obey the lawful orders of those who are above you. But it's, the military is funny. You're taught to obey the lawful orders of those above you, but you're not at liberty to determine whether it's a lawful order or not. So you're really caught in a catch-22 there. You know, and depending on the level of maybe say discipline, I mean, particularly the Marines, you don't question. You're taught never to question. And Army's a little bit less than that, but and then you get in Air Force and it's just like being in a spa or something like that. They don't care, you know. It's a suggestion in the Air Force. So okay, any Air Force guys in here?
No, but my whole family.
Okay. So, but it this is not. Sometimes we read these things, we don't see. There's real human drama and dilemma going on here, particularly because this is about to split the royal family. Oh. You had a question there?
I wasn't here last week. What's the deal with his son? What is he doing?
His son. He told nobody to eat anything.
His son did.
And his son, Jonathan, was not there when he made the command. As a matter of fact, he's the one that started this big fight with the Philistines, right? He and his armor bearer, just two guys, went over there. How many did he kill? 20 guys, two guys. And that scared the Philistines, and that encouraged Saul to get his army to move on. That's when Saul said, don't eat anything until we win the victory. And then makes this curse. Curses anybody who eats anything until this is done. Well, again, Jonathan was not there when this command was given. Jonathan's coming back, and he sees a honeycomb. I don't know if it's in a tree or on the ground or what, you know, whatever. And he takes his spear, turns it over, dips his and he eats the honey. And he said, and then he said, "Oh, I'm refreshed because of the nourishment from the honey and stuff." And then people say, "Oh, you weren't supposed to do that because your father said such and such." And that brings us to where we are today, where these people and you, here's what Saul is really trying to say. All of this happened, including you eating that meat and stuff, because somebody did not obey my orders. And then he carries it to the highest degree. And even if it's my son, I'll kill him if he's the one that killed. And he doesn't even know that it is his son.
Oh, he doesn't know that.
I don't think he knows it at this time.
Not yet.
Okay? So again, he's trying to figure out why all this is happening. Why didn't God answer him? Why didn't he have direction? Why did these people eat that thing? Why would anybody do such a thing? And all these whys, he can't look in the mirror and say, "I'm the reason why." That's why, by the way, I'll tell you, that's why Saul is not a leader. That's why later on, it's the same issue right across the board. Later on, God will say, "You are no longer king." By the way, when he says that, it doesn't actually happen immediately. Okay, takes some time. But remember, after that, David is anointed king. But David's moving into the throne, moving on the throne, was a long process in and of itself, which we'll see. But so, yes.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
How is it that when you say that God anointed this person as king, how does it happen on the people level? How do they know that this is from God?
Because they had a prophet by the name of Samuel who spoke on God's behalf and said, "This is the man."
Well,
yeah, either they didn't, either they trusted what he said, or they'd have to declare him a false prophet and kill him. So, yeah. So to answer your question, the prophet, the genuine prophet spoke to the people on behalf of God. So. All right, so let's read on. Again, verse 30, nobody answered. Verse 40 said, then he said to all Israel, you be on one side, and my son and Jonathan and I will be on the other side. And the people said to Saul, do what seems good to you. So I always think about when I first read it, this is probably one of the first kangaroo courts that the world, you know, we're going to, me and my son, and what's interesting, it's not in his mind that anybody on his side is guilty. He and his son are going to be on one side and are going to view everybody else. And we'll find out. We'll find out who the guilty one is. Yeah. It's a funny thing. You got to be careful when you cast stones and cast aspersions and stuff. We had it's interesting. Several years ago when Teresa's grandmother died, she had two children that lived. She had three kids. One preceded her in death. So Teresa's dad and Teresa's aunt. And for some reason, all the grandkids, except for Teresa, because I wouldn't have taken a dime from the lady if I was dying, but had borrowed money from her. She kept them in this little thing. So Teresa's aunt says to Teresa's dad, we're going to go through this, and we're going to go through these lists and stuff, and whoever owes is going to pay what they owe, and then we'll split it up as part of our inheritance. That's what she said to him. So they get the little box out, and it has all these little things in there, and she starts reading who owes what and stuff. She goes, oh, we're not going to do that. And the reason was because her kids owed more than anybody else. You know, and I see this sometimes even in you know, some pastors who will change their view on something because their family's doing the thing that they know is biblically true. Well, I don't really hold that view anymore and stuff. One of the primary ones, if you remember, Oral Roberts and stuff? Richard Roberts was his son, or is his son, and Richard and Oral both were very strict about pastors could not be divorced and be pastors until Richard got a divorce. So to me, I always say there's a lack of integrity, and I'm not saying whether you believe pastors can be divorced or not. That's not the issue. The issue is you don't change what you believe to be true to fit the way you live your life. So if it's true, biblically true, it's true for the pastor's family as it is for everybody else's family. You know, so it's a funny thing that we do. So in Saul's mind, I'm sure he said, my family has no problem here. We're going to find out who out there did this. So that's what it is. He separates them out. Okay? And the people say, well, do. And it's interesting, most people probably know, you know, Saul's doing all this without knowledge and stuff. Verse 41 said, therefore Saul said to the Lord God of Israel, give a perfect lot. What's he asking God to do? To reveal the truth. Where else do you see lots? Jesus on the cross. I'm talking about lots using scripture stuff. Do you remember a people by the name of Achan? Remember what happened? The loot was taken. God says of Jericho, don't you take anything. This man named Achan took the thing. They went into Ai to fight Ai, and it should have been an easy battle for them, or they thought it would, and they were routed. And Joshua, he falls on his face before God, and God says to Joshua, quit praying, which is one of those interesting things. Quit praying. Get up and do what's right. Clean up this camp. There's sin in the camp. You clean it up. And they begin to cast lots. And if you read that scenario, you see it falls on, you know, certain tribes and certain clans all the way down to the family. And it finally rests on Achan and his family. That was a God-given revelation, if you will. And that's what Saul's asking for. God, show us the truth. The high priest, or if it was the high priest, it had the Urim and the Thurim, which was the kind of thing for them to help. It's God helping them make decisions and stuff. I don't fully understand that all. In the New Testament, you have lots that were cast for the 12th disciple. Remember that in the book of Acts.
Oh, yeah.
And Matthias ended up getting to be the 12th one, where the other guy did not and stuff. And I got a whole view on that one, but we'll let that one go. But
have you ever heard that the word Noah
as we all know in the Bible, that his name in Hebrew means new beginning.
I have not heard it. Ron?
I'm not sure, but it makes, would make sense.
Yeah, could be. I don't know. I can't answer. Yeah, I'm not saying it's not. It may be. All right. So, therefore, give us perfect lot. So Saul and Jonathan were taken, but the people escaped. So, basically, when the lots fell, this was an easy one to start with, because he divided everything into two. My family and y'all. I'm sure he believed it was going to fall on the big group.
Sure. Sure.
I can't even imagine that his jaw did not almost hit the floor when, you know, when it fell on, because it's only him and Jonathan. And so, and Saul says, cast lots between my son Jonathan and me. So Jonathan was taken. So I find this interesting. Here's what I find interesting. What was the question that the king was asking? Well, who did what they weren't supposed to do? It's not really who was responsible. I always think when I read this, you know, if the lot fell on who was responsible, I would think God would put that lot on Saul, but he didn't. He was asking about, you know, who did what they weren't supposed to do. And so, verse 43, then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. And Jonathan told him and said, I only taste a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand. So now I must die? Okay, so again, he just said, I taste a little bit of honey, so now I must die. Now, think worse thought what Saul's thinking right now. These people ate meat with blood in it, sinned against God. We built the altar.
Intentionally.
Okay, huh?
They intentionally sinned.
Right, and now we built the altar. We did things right. I called the priest. We prayed, God didn't answer, so there must be sin in the camp. Who is this? It's whoever initiated this. Now it's, we find out that that's Jonathan. But think about even the crazy degree here. Whoever is responsible for this will be put to death. So, and that's what Jonathan basically says to his dad. He says, I have to die because I took a little bit of honey. And, you know, he didn't even say, I took a little bit of honey doing something that I didn't even hear you declared. Or you decreed. So, verse 44 said, and Saul answered, God do so and more also, if you shall surely, for you shall surely die, Jonathan. This is craziness. And you know why he has to do it that way? Because if you go back to verse 39. And those initial words, as the Lord lives, the one who protects Israel. He said that before the whole group. So he attributed God's name to what was about to happen. And he could not pull back from it. And now he carries this even further. He says, you know what? May the Lord do to me even more if you don't die. So he's basically saying, I made a vow to God, and this vow has to be fulfilled. Now, there's another crazy vow in the book of Judges. Remember that crazy vow? About the guy who says the first thing, says to God, the first thing that comes through my door, I'll sacrifice to you. Which is just, I'm thinking, what kind of nut says that? And what was the first thing that came through the door?
His daughter
came through the door. It's just craziness. There's no way in my mind I can believe that's of God. And there's no way in my mind that I can even justify, you know, again, why didn't that guy say, God, forgive me for being so stupid? And I'm not supposed to say stupid in a lesson thing, but that's stupid. You know? And why didn't, see, Saul is so puffed up and so unaware of his own failing. That even now, when he made such a dumb vow, a dumb decree that would kill his own son, he can't humble himself before God and say, God, forgive me. He can't humble himself for his people and say, you know what? This whole day is a mess because of me. And you know what? He can't even say, you know what? Jonathan really can't be responsible for disobeying me because he didn't hear me say it in the first place. It's just, nothing seems right here. But what we do see is a man that's unwilling to acknowledge his own part in this whole thing, and realizing that his poor decision making and his are about to affect someone that's innocent. Jonathan is innocent before God on this whole thing.
You see that,
and he actually is innocent before the king. Go ahead.
You see it in leaders all the time, yeah, to this day.
Yeah, that they won't acknowledge, I made a mistake.
Yeah.
I misspoke. You know?
Yeah.
It really is a pride issue and stuff. And you know, and sometimes when I do marriage counseling and stuff, that becomes an issue for a lot of people. Where one won't say to the other, or both won't say to each other, I'm sorry. You know? And you can't have a relationship with somebody, a healthy one anyway, if you're not willing to say I'm sorry, because all of us are going to mess up, all of us are going to say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, and boy, if you can't forgive one another, you're just not going to, that relationship is not going to work. So, but I think Saul thought he was above, actually above, this is a sad thing, he was above humbling himself even before his people. And by the way, later on, I think it's part of what Samuel says to him. He says, when you were little in your own eyes, God called you. All this speaks of Saul thinking, I'm king. I don't have to answer to anybody. I don't have to acknowledge any weaknesses, any faults, any bad decision. If I make them, they're good because I made them. And, you know, nobody likes to be around a person like that, right? So, Any other questions or comments on that? All right, verse 45. But the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die, who has accomplished his great salvation in Israel? Certainly not. As the Lord lives, not one hair on his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day. So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. So the people...
they knew what was right.
They knew what was right.
Yeah.
They knew that Jonathan was an innocent man. Not only was he an innocent man, he was used of God in a great way that day. This whole victory would have never happened if it wasn't for Jonathan listening to God. He wouldn't have gone with his armor bearer, killed those 20, which encouraged Saul and his armies to come. Remember, they were scattering everywhere. They were fearful. And two men took on 20 and put the fear of God, if you will, into the Philistines, which made them easier prey, because remember, by the time Saul got there, it really wasn't that Israel won any victory that day. It was that the Philistines started killing each other. God put confusion in the camps, what it says. Every man, with the time Saul and his army got there and looked down upon the Philistines, they saw a battle going on that the Jewish guys weren't even involved in. The Philistines were killing each other.
Seriously?
Yeah. Now you read that earlier in the chapter. It's what we talked about last week. You know, so the whole thing is nuts. Saul wants this great banquet for himself, to acknowledge himself, but really it's God who did everything that did that there. He makes this incredibly poor decision about eating, about nourishment and stuff. And now when God doesn't answer him in what he considers to be a timely manner, he assumes he has the heart of God or the mind of God, and he assumes that he's got to find out what the problem is. And he's going to take care of the problem.
Does he think that God told him not to let everybody eat? Or did he just
no, say I don't, that there's no him? Indication of anything. God, the problem with Saul was God. He hadn't been listening to God at all. What was clear last week is that his son Jonathan was listening to God. Remember that he stood there and said, "Okay, God, you show me. If they do this when I yell something out, then that means let's go attack them. If they don't do this, that means we pull back." So he yells out to him. He shows himself to him, and they responded in the way that he felt like the Holy Spirit led him and said, go. That's when they went and they defeated the 20 and changed everything. But you don't have any of that with Saul. Again, you have an indication here. We go back to verse 40 where he says, and in verse 41 where he talks about, God, tell me what to do. But he's not willing to listen. Yeah, it's like people who want to know the will of God but are not willing to do the will of God. Why would God tell us anything if we have no intent of doing it? You know, so
He's just kind of going through the motions
to yeah.
make himself look good.
I think that's all of that. And I think, again, he has set himself, he wants to be, I see Saul at this point wanting to move in the office of not only, I think he wants to fulfill all the offices. He wants to be prophet, priest, and king. But God didn't call him to that. He called him to be king. Because earlier he did the work of the prophet Samuel. Okay? And here, by the way, he's trying to do the work, you know, of the prophet, declaring certain things. But all his declarations are not God-given declaration. We've already been told God didn't answer him. Everybody got that? So if God didn't answer him, he has no place to make any other declarations like whoever's responsible for this is going to be killed. So he made that declaration without the guidance of God. And that's what I've been trying to say is sometimes we ask God and we don't want to wait upon God, and then we presume upon God what we think is right when God never said it. And so this whole scenario, there's nothing godly in what Saul's doing here at all. Yet, I'm convinced in his mind he thinks it all is. He thinks he and God are this close. No.
It's like the people there, they see that, but that's not...
Yeah.
That he doesn't really have this, you know... these callings from God. Because up to, I think it's interesting up to this last part here, that the people are just kind of going along with him and saying, do what seems good to you. It's not that they agree with him.
Right,
they're just saying,
right, you're right.
It seems good to you. Up until...
This, a decision is made, which is crazy.
Until, yeah, that's crazy. So they see...
The people did what was right. By the way, this is another indicator of Saul losing... his ability to be king.
It's like they're saying, "Do what's going to be good for you," because that's what he's going to do anyway.
Right.
So,
but later on, with the Amalekites and stuff, when Samuel catches him because he didn't do what God said, what was his excuse? He says, "The people." So once again, you know, and at that point, right here, we see he does not have control. The people are not going to put up with that. Okay. Later on, he verbalizes that he doesn't have control, and he really abdicates his position as king. He personally did. Here, we see it comes into question, no doubt about it. But when he blames the people for doing opposite of what they should have done, then Samuel basically says, "You're no longer king."
You know, we see Jonathan as more of a man of God than Saul.
Clearly. Yeah, clearly Jonathan has a heart after God. And the people see that too. The people know.
It must have been quite a blow to Saul when the people stood up against him. That's what
little doubt. I mean, his ego must have took a big punch right then. There's no doubt about that. Okay. So they rescued him. Look at verse 46. Then Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. So his question was never asked. Answered, I mean. God never said, yeah, go after him and I'll give you victory. Again, why would God answer his question or his prayer or his request and stuff when Saul's going to do what Saul wants to do anyway? But part of this, I think, also, of where it says he left and went, you talk about being deflated very quickly. Kill Jonathan. It'll make everything right. And the people say, oh no, we're not going to do this. That's not right. I mean, he's listening. Think about being the king that's standing there all alone. You know, what are you going to do? What are you? Time to go home. Give me my basketball. I'm going home. You know, we've seen that. You know, I'm taking my ball and going home because nobody will play with me, right? So I can't be in charge. So I'm going home. And that's all. To me, that's one of the first pictures of the Bible I see that where like, no one's going to listen, so I'm just going home. So, questions or comments on that? Verse 47 says, so Saul established his sovereignty over Israel and fought against all the enemies on every side, against Moab, against the people of Ammon, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, against the Philistines. Whatever he turned, wherever he turned, he harassed them. So it is almost as if Saul goes full-blown militaristic. Okay? And so... when it talks about sovereign, I think this speaks of a personal power or personal his own personal will to take control over things, because he was not going to let happen ever again from his thing what just happened here, where the people made a decision. So I think that's actually what he tries to describe there. And that verse 47 is one of the overall verses which just talk about looking, even looking some in the future, not immediate stuff, in the future, speaking of how Saul basically built his legacy.
It's interesting when you read that, because, I mean, what else do kings do? They go to war.
Yeah.
They were supposed to claim the land.
Yeah.
Kill all the rebels out, you know. And so he did the only thing he knew to do, go to war. And the only time we see a king who didn't do that was David, and he got in trouble by not going to war.
Yes, David. Yeah, well,
that's what kings do. They go to war. That's what the scripture says.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so verse 48 said, "And he gathered an army and attacked the Amalekites and delivered Israel from the hands of those who plundered them." Now, again, remember, Saul was a military leader. There's no disputing that, okay? And I think there's a lot of pride for Saul in the victories that he won. Later on, when they praised David instead of Saul, and boy, his ego just really takes a hit then. It really bothered him. But he is establishing his kingdom is what he's doing right now. He's establishing his power. Now you say, can he do that without God? Well, there are many kings that do it without God. The incredibly sad thing is, what could have been if he would have done it in response to God? He would have been a great king.
Yeah, it's the short term.
Yeah, yeah. And because of his disobedience, the kingdom was taken out of his hand, so none of his descendants would ever set as king. So, verse 49. Now the sons of Saul were Jonathan, Jeshui, and Mal. Thank you. And the names of his two daughters were these. The name of his firstborn was Merab, and the name of the younger was Michael. Michael, yeah, we'll go with Michael. The name of Sarah's wife was, thank you, and daughter, the daughter of this guy. And the name of the commander of his army was, and here's the first time we hear of this guy, Abner. And that Abner was Saul's uncle. So he kind of kept it all in the family. Talk about nepotism. So we have some, you know, going on here. Kish was the father of Saul, and Ner, the father of Abner, was the son of Abiel. Now, there was a fierce war with the Philistines all the days of Saul, and when Saul saw any stronger man or any valiant man, he took him for himself. So basically he said, Saul would never defeat the Philistines. So that's that statement. All the years of his reign, the Philistines would be an issue with him. And every time he saw someone that he thought was great, strong, so he would, you could say he put them in his own guard.
Yeah, he conscripted
them. They were his special forces, you know. He kept those guys close to him. Okay.
So how is the span of years this is happening?
Basically, if you look from 47 to 52, that speaks of all of his reign after this time, which would probably be close to 35 years.
Because I thought he defeated the Philistines.
Just in battles. He didn't even earlier. He never destroyed the Philistines. Because David had to deal with the Philistines also.
He just beat him in skirmishes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Next week in chapter 15, we're gonna look at a time where it is declared that Saul has lost his kingdom. And we'll talk about the reasons why next week on that. Okay?
Now I know what it means when it says